Good evening. This is the NLA Hams Net. It's held every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. It's 6 p.m. Mountain Time, but it's 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, or Eastern Time. And here we talk about things NLA-ish and Hamish. And tonight, I'm coming to you from the park and ride at the Berthoud exit on I-25. So there, you can isolate exactly where I am so you can dial in the missiles. My name is Terry. I'm Terry from Colorado. If you want to look me up, I'm KI0RE. That's my call sign. I'm an amateur radio operator. I'm an extra class. And that's my call sign. You can look it up on the net. And we've been talking about the ham radio license manual, third edition. Technician level, which is good through June 30th. Test questions in the back are good through June 30th, 2018. And we're on page 7-17, paragraph 7.4. So there we go. And it talks about international rules. And it introduces you to the International Telecommunications Union. The FCC doesn't have authority in other countries. Every country has its equivalent agency, though. How do they coordinate? It would be chaos if every country made up their own allocation, since radio waves don't stop at international borders. Realizing the need for the international coordination, the International Telecommunication Union, ITU, was formed as an agency of the United Nations in 1949. Now, even though they're connected to the United Nations, and I don't have a very high opinion of the United Nations, this one has been a big help because we've been able to deconflict some things. There's still that European station up on 7.15, I believe it is, megahertz, that is right in the middle of our one of our ham bands. It's a commercial station, but that's okay. For the most part, we've actually gotten more frequencies okayed because there are frequencies in other places, and we just had to make a few changes and make them available to hams here. Regions. The IETU divides the world into three regions, shown in Figure 7.5, and organizes frequency allocations accordingly. North and South America, including Alaska and Hawaii, form Region 2. Some U.S. possessions and territories in the Pacific are located in Region 3. Because VHF and UHF signals frequently do not travel far beyond the radio horizon, it was decided that allocations in these frequency ranges did not have to align precisely. As a result, the amateur allocations vary between regions. Table 7.2 shows allocations for amateur radio above 50 megahertz in Region 2. Allocations on those bands are different for amateurs in Regions 1 and 3. And you need to know this because if we have a reciprocal agreement, we'll be getting to that. You need to know how to operate officially, legally, in the country that you're going to. And you can do that as a ham radio operator. But you need to obey their rules when you're in that country. HF allocations are more consistent between regions, although there are some variations that affect U.S. amateurs, and I kind of hinted at some of that. For example, allocations for U.S. hams operating in Region 3, such as Guam, KH2, and when I say KH2, that means that everybody in Guam has a call sign that starts with KH2, or Wake Island, KH9. There's a couple for Hawaii and Alaska, too. I think Hawaii is KHI, and Alaska is KHL, I believe. And I'm not sure about that. Privilege allocation rules are fairly consistent within a single region, and I'm looking at the chart on Figure 7.5, and it's pretty straightforward. The Americas are Region 2. Region 1 is the entire, what used to be the Soviet Union, is now Russia. China and India and Australia are in Region 3, so that's kind of like the southern Indian and Pacific Oceans. Africa and Europe are in Region 1, along with the rest of Russia. And let's see, what do we have here? Radio rules change at region boundaries, regardless of your citizenship or the ownership of the vessel or aircraft. If you operate maritime mobile, for example, when you cross from Region 2 to Region 1, you will then have to operate according to Region 1 rule. That's true even if you're a citizen of Region 2 country and the vessel is flagged in a country from Region 3. So it talks about international operating. It can be a lot of fun, and you can operate. What they do is they do a de-expedition, and DX stands for distance. And they'll go to some obscure island down by Antarctica or in the middle of the Indian Ocean or someplace in the Atlantic or, you know, really remote location. And they'll set up a group. They'll go down there and set up, and they'll operate for a week, 2 weeks, whatever they can afford to do. And they make as many contacts as they can. And they're kind of fun because they make up their own special QSL cards, and it's kind of neat to watch those and listen to them because they're talking to some place that, gee, not very many radio operators operate from there. So let's see. To operate using your U.S. amateur license, there must be a reciprocal operating agreement between the countries, and I can't stress that enough. There are three ways of getting operating permission, reciprocal operating authority, an international amateur radio permit, IARP, and the European Conference of Postal and Telecommunications Administration, CEPT, license agreement. For more information on these agreements, information is available on the ARRL's website. And this is changing all the time. You got to look at it like months before you go so you can deal with these government agencies, and then the week you go, 2 days before you're bound to leave, you need to check it one more time because things change. And then that talks about reciprocal operating authority. Many countries have entered into reciprocal operating authority agreements with the United States, recognizing each other's amateur license. This is a government-to-government agreement recognizing each other's amateur license. No additional information is required. Just take a copy of your U.S. license with you. Check with your local licensing authorities about filing an application and any fees before you're operating. You must follow your host country's rules and regulations, and that's what I was talking about a while ago. There's a little blue box on the International Amateur Radio Union. I have not dealt with them, but they've been there for a long time, and they're pretty good. International Amateur Radio Permit in some Central and South American countries, IARP, allows U.S. amateurs to operate without seeking a special license or permit to enter and operate from that country. You got to check with everybody, though. You need to read this. And, you know, it doesn't apply to everybody. It only applies to people going outside the United States or getting close to Line A up in Canada or up near the border of Canada, I should say. So it doesn't apply to everybody. When you decide you got your ham license and you want to go, I very much encourage you to look at the different licensing reciprocal authority entities, government organizations, and follow what they tell you to do. And I'm not going to go through them all right here, but I'm not going to worry about it because not many people have to do that. So check into it when you want to travel overseas and use your ham radio. Oh, just to make one little note, there are some islands or beaches, and you can go down there as a ham, and the radios and the antennas and the power supplies, everything you need is already in place. All you got to do is rent this place. So while you have fun out on the beach, and maybe you dance, whatever it is you're going to do down there to have a vacation, you can also be talking on the radio from there. And they're great spots to go, and it's great operating fun to say, oh, this is KI0RE from wherever it is, and it's not Colorado. Call signs. I'm going to move on to call signs, paragraph 7.5, page 7-19. Every amateur call sign has a prefix and a suffix. In the United States, an amateur call sign prefix consists of one or two letters and one numeral. And that number has a special thing. Its suffix contains one to three letters. And this is important because it kind of tells you a little something about where somebody is from and what level their license is sometime. For example, W3ABC is a valid U.S. amateur call sign, while KDKA and KAMA3505 are call signs from other U.S. radio services. So be prepared. Every country is assigned at least one unique block of prefixes. For example, U.S. amateur call signs begin with the letters K, N, W, or the two-letter combination AA through AL. No matter what, if you hear a call sign beginning with those letters, you know it's a U.S. call sign. Most Canadian hams use VA through VG. French hams use F. Japanese amateur call signs begin with a J. And hams from Singapore have call signs beginning with 9B. The suffix of a call sign is the unique part that identifies the particular station and consists of only letters. In the call W1AW, which happens to be ARRL in Newington, Connecticut, AW is a unique among, so I said W1AW, AW, the AW part, the last two letters, is unique among all other calls beginning with W1, known as W1 call. Suffixes are one, two, or three letters. The combination of prefix and suffix uniquely identify a station anywhere on Earth, and that's a fact. So if you look up KI0RE, everything you see about KI0RE is from me. It's my call sign. Within a country, the call signs can be assigned to indicate license classes or location or other special characteristics. Now, there's 10 U.S. call districts and call signs. And just to give you an idea, let's see, Alaska's KL7, Hawaii is KH6, so I was wrong a while ago. The other islands in the Pacific start with KH. Let's see, zero is Colorado. That's why I have a zero at my call sign. And few people like having a zero, but I think it's kind of cool. A zero in code is five dashes, and so it's one of the slowest call signs to do. You got to go da, 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 da. Okay, it's mostly the Great Plains, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, Minnesota, Iowa, and Missouri. That's the zero, zero land, if you will. And then one's up by Maine and New England. New York is a two, along with New Jersey. Three is Maryland and Delaware and Pennsylvania. Four is the Southeast, Kentucky, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, all down in there. Alabama is a four. Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi are five. That's five land. California has its own number. There's enough people out in California that they just gave it a six, all by its lonesome. Seven are all the states between zero and five land, and California, which includes the whole Northwest down through Nevada, Utah, and Arizona. And then, let's see, eight is West Virginia, Ohio, and Michigan, and nine is Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. So there you go, and you can look that up. Now,
question.
A U.S. call sign is further classified by the number of letters in the prefix and suffix. A call sign such as AA5BT with a two-letter prefix, like mine, KI0RE, AA is the two-letter suffix, two-letter prefix, and the two-letter suffix would be BT. So mine would be KI, that's my two-letter prefix. The zero says I'm from zero land because I'm in Colorado. And the BT on the end, like AA5BT that's written here, or RE, the end of KI0RE, is called a 2x2. So AA5BT and KI0RE is a 2x2. It's written 2 and then a multiplication sign, a little x, and then a 2 if you want. There's also, it's, as an example here, I used to be KC0BCP. So now you're getting my history. You're getting my CD background in there. And a lot of hams will make up sayings or acronyms or whatever you want to say. Out here in Colorado, we have K0OJ. Well, it just happens that that's a normally assigned call sign, and it went to a guy named Orland Jenkins. And they don't know him as Orland. They know him as OJ. And if you talk on ham radio, he's Cooge, K0OJ. Look, if you write it down, it looks like Cooge. And so everybody knows him as Cooge. And he's been around here in northern Colorado for many, many years. Lots of fun. So,
question?
Yes, go ahead.
Supposing you get your license, and like me, I'm in Pennsylvania, so I have a 3 number. And you move to another state, say, in the 0 category. Would they change your call sign, or would you keep your original, or is it optional?
I think it's optional. You've got your call sign for 10 years. As soon as you go to apply and re-up, then you need to think about whether you're going to change it. But you, if you want to change it to the current land, go ahead, but you don't have to. Because it doesn't matter. It's where you were issued the license. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yep. Another question. Just curious, are there any hams or have there been any hams that operated out of Antarctica? Low-frequency
yes,
range?
There have been. I used to have a poster on my wall that was a deexposition to an island just off the coast of Antarctica, about 3 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they didn't have to get through a whole bunch of stuff. But there, if you... before, when we had Bart Jr., there were times when, because we have the environmental research laboratories here in Boulder, there were people down there that came from the Boulder area. In other words, their families were here, and they were off doing a tour, which is 6 months down there during the night. The Antarctic nighttime, and they want to talk to their family. So we had a big beam up at Bart Jr.'s, and so Rip would turn the antenna down there and talk. And they have talked to him many times. So the different stations down there are a really prized QSL card to get. Because they do work it, it's not all the time, but it's a really prized QSL card when you can work the South Pole.
So,
there you go. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay. When you apply for your license, you'll probably get a 2x3. Mine used to be KC0BCP, and I would tell everybody that meant I was driving a pickup at the time, so it was Busted Crunch Pickup. Or somebody else called me a big candy pumpkin one time, BCP. So, and I could say it like a Scottish or an Irish brogue, you know, KC0BCP. So I had a lot of fun with it. But that's my old call sign. I don't use it anymore, and I don't have to use it now. So this is great. I got KI0RE. So Cooge, who has K0OJ, and we call him Cooge because that's what it looks like when you write it down. He calls me Kiore because I'm K-I-0-R-E. It looks like that. Kiore. He says it sounds Italian. People do a lot of stuff with it. Portable and upgrade. Assuming your call is granted in the continental U.S., you can operate anywhere within the U.S. with the same call. You're probably identified as a U.S. ham on the air, and there is no requirement for you to indicate that where the country you happen to be. However, hams often add a portable designator following the call sign if they're operating somewhere outside the district that they would otherwise be indicated by the numeral in the prefix. For example, if N0AX operates while driving through California, he might give his call sign as N0AX/6, spoken as N0AX portable 6 or N0AX/6. If using CW, you always want to use as few of stuff as you can. Portable is too much to spell as CW, which CW is continuous wave, which means code. The word portable used here may be replaced by slant or slash or some other word that separates the call sign from the indicator. Okay, everybody got that?
Yep.
If you're operating outside the U.S., you must add the prefix of the country to your call because you are no longer in your home country. If you travel to Canada, for instance, you are then required to sign your call sign and follow it with portable VE hash sign, where the hash sign indicates the Canadian province in their call sign system. So they just break it up by province. For example, N0AX/BE3. If you go to Hawaii, a U.S. state, but not part of the continental U.S., you would, and I don't know. I do want to mention one thing here in a minute. You call sign followed by portable KH6. Similar requirements to just other countries. Okay, it's no big deal. /MOB or mobile, general, say, AG. Okay, when you upgrade your license, as soon as you receive your CSCE, which is, we talked about that last week or week before the last, that's a completion certification that you passed the test. From the VE's exam, you can append the portable designator to indicate your new license. So, like, if you were a tech and you've got your general license, you can say portable AG or /AG on the end. Or amateur extra, you say portable AE, which stands for amateur extra. That's an extra class. And you have upgraded your license, although the database doesn't show the change. Choosing a call sign, you can also choose your call sign. You can apply for what's called a vanity call, and you can make it anything you want. RIP got the vanity call V0OM. Or it was a V0M. No, it's V0M. V0OM, which it stands for volt ohmmeter. And they thought that was pretty cute. And then you have club and special events. I mentioned W0W the other day, which was a call sign that we got for, and then for many years we got it because we kept reapplying at the same time early. For the first weekend after the summer was done and kids were going back to school, we would do a kind of like a all-day-long call just to see how many people we could contact at Rip and Ellie's, Bart Jr.'s, and our call sign would be W0W, which stands for WOW, and it was pretty good. And then there's club call signs. There's special call signs. That's what I was talking about. And all you got to do is apply. And you ask for them. If they're available, they'll give them to you. If they're not available, they'll say, oh, that one's being used already at that time, so give me something else. You usually have to put in 3 or 4 examples before you go in. Like, you might do K1DF for kids, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, are there any questions on anything we said so far? I think that polished off Chapter 7, and we can actually go into the regulations in Chapter 8, which I don't know if you want to do that or not. How are we doing there, Jan?
Well, sounds okay. I have no further questions.
Okay. Chapter 8, it gets into the operating regulations. And I like the way they designed this book. You don't get to the really... You get to the really fun part up front, and then you get to the dry and the, you know, detailed stuff that you have to know back at the back. And that's okay. There's not too many chapters left in the book. I think there's 2 more. And but you need to know this. So I'll just get as far as I can, and please interrupt me if there's anybody who has questions. Page 8-1, paragraph 8.1. Control operators, all transmissions, must be made under the control of a control operator. And if you have a license, that's you. If you're talking on somebody else's radio, that's them. A properly licensed operator who is responsible, that's a control operator, is a properly licensed operator who is responsible for making sure all FCC rules are followed. There can be only one control operator per station at a time. That's the person responsible for station operation, no matter who is actually speaking into the microphone. I can't overemphasize that enough. You let somebody talk on your radio and they're doing it haphazardly and they're not saying the right things or they're acting potty mouthed on the thing. It's your radio, your station, and you're the control operator, and you're the one that gets the fine, not your friend. So, be aware. Reading the rules themselves can be a bit confusing, so let's be sure you clearly define them. A control operator is the amateur radio operator, designated as responsible for making sure that transmissions comply with FCC rules. He's gay. A control operator must be named in the FCC Amateur License Database or be an alien with reciprocal operating authorizations, and we just talked about that just a minute ago. The FCC wants to be able to know who you are, and that call sign is how they do it. Oh, and then there's a picture where it says there's a lady and a young girl sitting next to her. And she's got the radio and talking. It says, Rebecca, KS4RX, left, and X-class licensee, access control operator for Amanda, KG4NBF, a technician class licensee, during field day. Rebecca is responsible for making sure all FCC rules are followed when the station is operating on bands and modes not available to technicians. So that's kind of the nice thing. When you do field day, you're exercising your equipment, and you might be operating on some HF frequency that your license doesn't allow you to operate on that frequency. But if there's a control operator right there that can shut you down, they have to have control of the rig. You can operate on the bands as long as they're there with you to make sure that you don't violate any rules or regulations. As a control operator, you may operate the station in any way permitted by the privilege of your license class. It doesn't matter what the station's owner privileges are, only the privileges of the control operator. When the station owner and the control operator are the same person, responsibilities are easy to understand. Being a guest operator is very common. You can go to Newington, Connecticut, or if you live up that way, you can go to the headquarters, the ARRL, and they allow guest operators to sit down at the radio station and operate with their call sign under the W1AW station. And that's pretty cool because they have some nice stuff up there. If you live around D.C., contact Smithsonian. They have a radio, and they allow hams in to come and operate the radio. It's an operational station, and you get to send out your own QSL card from the Smithsonian Institute. It's really cool, and I told a story about that a few months ago. It's a good way to have a control operator there that is a higher class, because then you get used to operating and a place where you might not be able to. Like, you want to go down to 40 meters and talk to Russia. Well, how do I do that? I'm only a tech. Well, if you got a control operator there who will let you use their station, you can talk to Russia as a tech. And you're talking from their radio station. And that's perfectly fine. So, unlicensed operators, here's the situation that you may already have experienced. Have you visited a club or personal station and made a contact or two? Perhaps you took part in a field day. You can go in and do that as long as you're under the supervision of a control operator. There's nothing at all wrong with an unlicensed operator using an amateur station. And lots of times they call this third-party traffic. I have third-party carry. And they'll let you do it. Here, watch me. This is how you do it. And they go through the thing. And then you let them talk. and so they get to talk for a minute. It's kind of nice. It's not okay
question.
For family members. Yes.
In that case, do the frequencies selected have to be on their list of accepted frequencies, or can they use the higher license bands?
You can use the higher license privileges, which are greatly expanded from what your
right.
your technician license. And
right.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question?
Another question. I was just wondering if, for example, you use a satellite bounce to get a station. Is there anything different on a QS card they'll send you if it comes by satellite bounce, or is it not recognized in any way?
There's usually a block on some QSL cards, and some people will add it on the back of their QSL card that this was through a satellite, and they'll specify which satellite. Maybe it's the ISS, the International Space Station. And, no, there's no special requirements. If you can hit that satellite, you can talk to people on it, and you can create a QSL card.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. It's not okay for family members to operate while the licensed control operator is elsewhere on the property, doing a chore or grabbing a snack. The control operator must be present and ensuring that all FCC rules are met. One thing they can do, unlicensed operators can use the equipment to receive at any time. So that's one thing that a lot of people have used. W1AW up in Newington, Connecticut, the ARRL headquarters, puts out code on a regular basis. And that code is for practicing. And if you have a radio, you can't transmit it on it, but you can listen. And you can copy the code. And they usually copy a piece of manual or a piece of the magazine so that you know what it was supposed to say. And you compare what they transmitted and what and how you heard it and what you wrote down to the article that they transmitted. And that's a really good way to boost your code. Excellent way to boost your code. Okay, have we... beat that one enough, or any other questions?
No, I got mine answered.
Okay, we got about 10 minutes here. Identification, 8.2. In most contacts, the other party can't see you. They have no other way of identifying your signals other than your call sign. It's also important that other stations be able to determine who is transmitting. Your call sign is your identity on the air. Remember we said it was unique? By allocating these different letters to each country and then using the zero, the number, the single number in the middle as where you're at in that country, what region, and then these three letters or one, two, or three letter suffix on the end, that is a unique call sign that goes right down to you. And so that's how somebody tells who is doing the transmitting. So always give your call sign. And what's the rule, Jan? I'm giving your call sign.
Every 10 minutes.
And?
Good
question. At the end of the conversation.
Right.
Every 10 minutes at the end of the conversation. And so I remember it by saying to myself, every 10 and at the end. Okay? And that's a good way to remember it. Normal ID, sees, here's something. For example, to see if you are in reach of a distance, I'm not advocating this, maybe I should read the whole paragraph. The first rule of identification is that unidentified transmissions are not allowed, no matter how brief. Unidentified means no call sign was associated with the transmission, and I guarantee you, they will find you. They practice over... several square miles of area, maybe even tens of square miles area, hunting down what's called a fox. And if you routinely click and don't identify yourself, then they will get a triangulation on you, and then they will go to that spot the next time they think they're going to hear something from you. And eventually they will know where it's coming from, and they will identify you, and they will turn you into the FCC, and the government will come pounding on your door, knock, 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 and they will say, you are charged with. Well, they won't come pounding on your door. They'll send you a letter that says, you need to pay this fine for transmitting like that. If you need to make a short transmission to test an antenna or make adjustments to your radio, the stating or sending your call sign will suffice. For example, and you see this every day, to see if you are in reach of a distant repeater, don't just key the microphone and listen for a repeater signal. And I'm getting some background noise, Jan. Is that not me? Don't just key the microphone and listen to the repeater signal. That's called kerchunking because of the sound that everyone monitoring will have to listen to. Just state your call sign as you transmit. No problem. So what I do is if I want to see if I can hit, let's say, the 145-145 repeater on Squaw Mountain from right here. I've never tried it. I'm down in the basin of I don't know which river it is, but I just crossed over a river to get here. It's in Berthoud, Colorado. And I'm kind of a low spot, so I've got hills next to me. So I want to see if I can hit the 145-145 repeater. So I'll key up, I'll set the proper parameters to hit that repeater, and I'll key up, and all I'll do is key up and say KI0RE and let go. Now, I know whether I hit the repeater or not by whether the repeater answers me and identifies itself. Most repeaters identify themselves in code. Some of them identify themselves with voice, but you'll hear them. So I identified myself. If I just hit the button and let go, see if the repeater was there, I'll hear the repeater that I made it, but I just kerchunked, and I didn't identify my call sign. Bad news. Very bad form. Very bad form. People don't like that. We talked about every 10 and at the end. If you're ending a contact, just make sure you give your call sign. You don't have to give the other station's call sign either. The purpose of identification is to identify the source of your signal, not those of other stations. So everyone just gives their call sign to log off. That's fine. When we're working on the bike ride that I help do, I am rest stop logistics, or I am rest one, or I'm logistics. I'm just logistics. So I would somebody would call me and they'd say logistics. I'd say this is logistics. And go ahead. And they would tell me their message. I'd relay it. Maybe the person, the official I'm with, heard it. And then when he acknowledges it, I tell him back. And they say, okay, that's fine. And we got it all. I'm done. I end with my call sign, KI0RE. Flip. And then I'm off the network. And they can go on. And so everybody knows who just participated in that last conversation. And they know which one they want to. And that's what it talks about next. Tactical call signs or tactical IDs are used to help identify where a station is and what it is doing. Examples of tactical call signs include Waypoint 5, First Aid Station, Hollywood and Vine, Firewatch on Coldwater Ridge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Tactical calls don't replace regular call signs. And the regular identification rules apply. Give your FCC assigned call sign every 10 minutes or at the end of the communication. You do it at the end, you don't have to worry about the 10-minute rule unless you start talking and maybe you've got an accident and you're working the accident and you're coordinating where to send the fire and the police and the ambulance to. And you're on there for 10 minutes, give your call sign. But for 99 or more percent, you're just going to give your call sign at the end. You'll be fine. When a new operator takes over, or she simply gets her FCC assigned call sign along with her tactical call sign, such as this is NI or N10OJS as race headquarters. Okay, that's race headquarters. And then, as you can imagine, the net control at headquarters is talking a lot more because they're coordinating on the net. So every once in a while, if it's been 10 minutes, they go ahead and they give their call sign and why the repeater is being used and what special purpose is being used for. And then there's self-assigned indicators. And I think I'm going to stop right there. So it's getting pretty late, and I need to get to another meeting. So any questions on tonight's subjects, please call now. Hearing none, I'm going to close the net. This has been the NLA Hams Net. My name is Terry from Colorado. I am KI0RE. You can look up all you want on the net. I'm there. This net is held every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Rocky Mountain Time. We talk about things NLA-ish and Hamish. Everyone is welcome to participate. You do not have to have a ham license. You do not have to be a member of NLA. You just have to ask me a question. I'll answer it, just like Jan does. I appreciate everybody's participation tonight, and I hope you all have a great time. The net is now closed.